Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with world-renowned epidemiologist Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and also author of the 2017 book, The Deadliest Enemy. Dr. Osterholm warns we are only in the second inning of this pandemic and that absent a vaccine or effective treatment, we're headed for many more deaths in the U.S. before reaching herd immunity if we don't continue to practice social distancing and mask use. Lori Robertson also checks in. Managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Michael Osterholm here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. A renowned epidemiologist, Dr. Osterholm has advised the U.S. and numerous governments around the world on pandemic planning and preparedness. He's the author of more than 300 publications on infectious diseases and pandemic preparedness, including his 2017 book, The Deadliest Enemy, Our War with Killer Germs.
He was the interim CDC director and was the science envoy for health and security at the U.S. State Department, also serving in advisory capacities at the National Institutes of Health. He's a member of the National Academy of Medicine and the Council of Foreign Relations. Dr. Osterholm, thank you and welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you. It's my privilege to be with you.
You know, we're clearly at a war with an enemy that's infiltrated the whole world. And, you know, you were one of the clarion voices, along with some others, who predicted that this would come. And yet it didn't seem the world was listening and seems ill-prepared to respond to the threat of this novel coronavirus. You spent your career analyzing global health threats, Ebola, SARS, MERS, HIV, and the Spanish flu. You know, now here we are with COVID-19. You say we're only in the second, maybe third inning. I'm wondering if you could tell us about how you're thinking, whether it's a modeling, paints such a grim assessment of where we stand today.
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that, as the world knows, we're dealing with a coronavirus, not an influenza virus. Our previous experience with global pandemics from a respiratory transmitted infectious agent like a flu virus or a coronavirus really has given us some good evidence of what we would expect if it were a flu virus, but not with a coronavirus status. This hasn't happened before. So we're really in uncharted territories in that regard. We recognized early in January, when it was clear that there was substantial person-to-person transmission of this virus in China, that this was going to become a pandemic. And in fact, our center put out a document on January 20th stating as such, in which we also said that it would probably not show up as a global pandemic until the last week of February, first week of March, just because it would be introduced into countries around the world with all the transportation that we see today. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, just as we predicted, the end of February, early March, we started to see the major increases in places such as Iran, Italy, and New York City. Right. Since that time, the virus has continued to transmit around the world. And the question is, where is it going to go next? And we actually put together a document at the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. It's on our website, free of charge. What we know is that about 5 to 7% of the U.S. population has been infected with this virus to date. This virus is not going to slow down its transmission until it gets to 60 or 70% of the population infected, or that immunity occurs because of vaccine. And that means we have a lot more to go in terms of cases. And the question is, how is it going to get to the 60 or 70%? Is it going to be like influenza, where we see waves of illness, you know, big peaks that then give way to troughs that for weeks are almost absent of cases and then come back, or with the second wave? Or is it going to just be something we've not seen before, where we just have a slow burn, or for that matter, kind of in between model, where it has peaks and valleys in different locations over time? And that's the part we just have to be humble right now and say, we don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Well, Dr. Osterholm, one of the things I think everybody finds disturbing about this global response to the pandemic is how disjointed it's been. We've seen really different approaches from country to country, and certainly many global health experts have called the U.S. response disastrous, given the highest death tolls in the world that we've seen. And you've advised presidential administrations, governments around the world on how to prepare for and confront pandemics. If you would, just contrast the U.S. response to the response of other countries, and what should we be doing that we aren't as a country?
Well, it's virtually impossible to compare and contrast other countries because everybody's done a little bit different in their approach. It also matters when you pick it up and where you pick it up. If you find the early cases that occur in a given location, you may have a better chance with testing and contact tracing to help shut down that ongoing transmission. You also have to be in an area where you don't have a substantial amount of traffic occurring between jurisdictions or locations. It's much easier when you're an island like New Zealand or Iceland, where you pick it up early, where you then can have the kind of comprehensive programs. But I think you've seen even in places like China, where right now we're sitting on top of an exploding outbreak in Beijing. And of course, just a few weeks ago, everybody kept touting China as being the ideal country in terms of response, while some of those were very draconian measures to keep people in their homes for weeks and weeks and weeks. It did suppress transmission. Now today, we're saying that, you know, this is kind of a leaky bucket virus. If you have even a small leak in it, it's going to get out. It's going to find people. And so in terms of our country, you know, we were very late to the game. Our testing problems were real. We couldn't test and we didn't test. We couldn't get into the world of contact tracing. I think we had a tremendous amount of denial about what was about to happen. We had a lot of even experts saying, oh, it's low risk. You know, at this point, we can go back and read the history of what happened. What we have to do is move forward. I published an article in this month's issue of Foreign Affairs. The first paragraph of that article is taken from the first paragraph of my 2005 foreign affairs paper about why we needed to prepare for a pandemic. What we could have and should have done today is what I'm really worried about is we're not preparing for what's left. This pandemic is, as it was noted, is in the earliest innings of this game. And we need to understand we have a lot more to go, and we're not even preparing for that, even with the warning we're getting.
Let's pull the thread on sort of preparation. In your book, The Deadliest Enemy, you outline very clearly 9-point battle plan for confronting the pandemic. And short of a vaccine, I'm wondering what federal, state, and local governments should be doing right now. But I guess I'm just generally troubled of why we haven't been able to translate what the scientists have said into public policy. But what's the strategy going forward?
Well, I think the challenge we have today is, what is the science telling us? You know, I unfortunately see many people who are willing to talk to the media with pronouncements about certain things with a great deal of certainty. You know, is there going to be a summer wave, or is there going to be a summer trough? Why are we seeing transmission, for example, today in what is roughly 20 states in the United States where transmission is going up? On the other hand, we have 20 states where, in fact, transmission has been reduced over the last 14 days in terms of new cases. Can you explain to me why that's happening? None of us can, and yet I see people talk with authority about what's causing the cases to be increased. And I sit here and say, as an epidemiologist, you know, the same things are happening in those states where they're continuing to decrease. We have many issues like this that have really been a challenge to come up with. What do we need to do? Now, knowing that we're talking about a respiratory transmitted pathogen largely, it makes perfect sense. Distance, distance, distance is by far the most important thing that we can recommend. Well, then how do you distance in such a way that you don't shut down not only the economy, but even kill society? And at the same time, how do you keep hospitals like we're seeing right now in some of these states, which their intensive care units are overflowing? And so I think one of the challenges, we've not had a national agenda. We've not had a national plan. We have lost a lot of the public's willingness to work with us on these issues because one size fits all approaches were taken. And for some counties where there hasn't even been a documented case yet of COVID-19, they're asking, why are we still in lockdown? And so I think that the challenge we've had is we've not had that kind of open and I think really necessary discussion, even debate about what are the best things to do right now to actually protect the public.
Well, Dr. Osterholm, I'd like to maybe jump off from that a little bit to talk about those people who are most at risk. And as you may know, we're very engaged in community health and primary care. We certainly recognize age as a key risk factor. Race and ethnicity have emerged as very significant factors in terms of who survives. Chronic health conditions like diabetes, major factor. Obesity seems to be a major factor. Maybe you could tell us a little more about these risk factors as we collect data from around the United States, but also the world. How should we be calibrating the public health response to include these factors in protecting the public?
Well, the need to include these factors in anything that we do in terms of recommendations is absolutely essential. What we need to do is prevent the cases that are most likely to cause serious illness or death. That's what this has been about, I think, from day one. None of us had an illusion that we could somehow stop this pandemic. It's like trying to stop the wind.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is delay as many case onsets as we can until we hopefully will have an effective and safe vaccine. Our challenge is that almost 40% of the population of age 18 and older today, right, excluding gender,
yeah,
are at some form of increased risk, yeah, for having a serious outcome. Today, the obesity epidemic is converging with this pandemic, creating, I think, a serious challenges for us. If you look at many places in the United States, the most frequently cited underlying health concern among those who are severely ill under the age of 55, it's been obesity.
Yeah.
When you look, though, at the other hand, we have many, many people living today with chronic diseases. That actually is one of the good things that has come out of our healthcare system. Many of the 790,000 Americans who live today with end-stage renal disease wouldn't have been alive and for a 1957 or 68 pandemic. Today they are. And so what we need to understand is that bubbling the at-risk population is not nearly as simple as it may seem to be when you're talking about 40% of the population.
Right.
At the same time, for those who are younger, those who are otherwise healthy, should they be locked up in a sense from participating in everyday life? Now, I would argue that for their health, they are at very low risk relative to those who are older who have underlying health conditions. The one concern I'd have about that, though, is remember, they're still the ones having contact with grandpa and grandma,
yeah,
with other people in the community who are at potentially high risk of having a serious outcome. And so when you think about them becoming infected, it's not just that they become infected about themselves, but do they then serve to transmit to others? Mm-hmm. We don't have a national plan. We don't have a global plan right,
yeah,
now for how to best deal with this. And that's the challenge that we face. And we have a lot of runway left to carry. Only 5 to 7% of the U.S. population has been infected with this virus to date. To get to 60 or 70% infection before you just begin to slow down,
yeah,
the transmission is remarkable. So I always tell people, think about the fact that this 5 to 7% level, think how much pain, suffering, death, and economic disruptions occurred with that. Imagine what we have left to go.
Yeah. We're speaking today with Dr. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, renowned epidemiologist. His 2017 book, The Deadliest Enemy, Our War with Killer Germs, predicted exactly the kind of pandemic experience that we're having right now. I want to get back to the issue of the vaccine and just get your thoughts on where do you think that is. I think a lot of people have their hopes, or the president say that we're going to have one sooner than later. It may not go through the third phase of testing here, which would be somewhat of a concern. But I do also want you to address this issue of serious outcomes. There's a new treatment that seems to be out there around infection that may prevent some deaths. Is there anything that in the short term might change the trajectory that would give you some hope? I note in some of those SARS and MERS vaccines were a long time in coming. So what's your general view of interventions that we might see, whether it's short-term interventions or the vaccine?
Let me first stick with the vaccines. We are hopeful for a vaccine, but we also know hope is not a strategy. In that context, there are now over 120 vaccines that are being considered in a number of different categories of how they might work. We know that coronaviruses can be a challenge, and that to develop immunity doesn't mean necessarily it's durable immunity, meaning that if you're an acute case today becoming clinically ill, you recover, but that does it persist? And there's real questions about that. The same thing is true for the vaccine itself. You know, if we get a short-term fix vaccine that might wait a year or two, that could still be a great tool, but it wouldn't solve the kind of problems we'd like to solve by having a vaccine that might protect you for 20, 30, or 40 years. We do have concerns about the potential safety issues related to this vaccine. There was a condition known as antibody-dependent enhancement, where making just a little bit of antibody or having the immune system prime just a little bit may actually mean that when you get infected with the real virus, your outcome's much worse. So where am I at on the vaccines today? I think everything that can be done is being done with these different vaccines to study them. I would urge that we do not take any shortcuts, even though this is a crisis. That will come back, I think, to haunt us. The public won't trust the vaccines. And, you know, a vaccine is just a vaccine. It's vaccination that makes the difference.
Right.
If you got to get it into people before you can really make a difference in terms of the disease itself. You know, I don't think it's a slam dunk. I can't under any condition imagine we'd have a safe and effective vaccine available for use in this country by the end of this year. If it does, I think many people will feel very uncomfortable that it's been rushed. At the same time, we understand we're living in the middle of a horrible, horrible pandemic. We need to throw whatever we can at it with some relative degree of safety. So I think the vaccine thing is a stay tuned issue. Don't hang on every press release that comes out today about vaccines. I think we've already witnessed how we've tried to, in a sense, inform science through press releases, and I think it's been a failure. We shouldn't do that. We need to get the publications. We need to get the data review out. In terms of drugs, the same thing. Today we're dealing with one, a corticosteroid that has been shown in one study in England that it reduced the morbidity and mortality in people who were on ventilators or receiving oxygen. This is a preliminary study. It's only a press release. We've already seen the challenges of trying to understand science through press releases. We need to get the data to look at this more carefully, and we need to have other centers looking at the same issue. But it surely could be an advantage over obviously the number of people dying. One challenge with this drug that hadn't yet really been discussed is that if we do save these people's lives, what does this do to intensive care medicine and and the actual bed availability? So instead of dying at 6 to 9 days, I now die at you know, at 18 to 20 days, or I don't die, but it takes me until 18 or 20 days to get out of the ICU. That will only double up the number of people who need ICU beds, which is a challenge in of itself. So, you know, I'm excited by the kinds of activities that are going on with Godspeed. I think that overall, most of them are quite deliberative. They're really working to get the kind of information we need. And I wish I could give you more, except for the very earliest stages of what's happening.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Osterholm, your analyses and the way you bring the benefit of all your years of experience to this basically leaves little room for illusions. We are still in the first wave of this pandemic, and although yesterday, I think yesterday or the day before, there was some you know, prominent mention that there would not be a second wave, I think you have made it clear you expect this virus to behave like others we've seen throughout history, where it may go away, the waves and the troughs. But you you advise governments, the National Academy of Medicine, and I think very importantly, our frontline healthcare workforce. And we'd like to ask you, what kind of preparation should we be doing now to be ready for the next wave? We have an opportunity, right, to continue to educate and prepare our patient population to make sure that we're not reservoirs for transmitting infection, but also be preparing for a next big wave. Tell us, you know, from teaching institutions to healthcare institutions, what should we be doing to plan for the fall and beyond?
Well, I think there is one overriding arching principle that has to be addressed, and that is we must protect our healthcare workers from becoming infected with this virus. Right now, we have at least 680 Americans who have worked in healthcare and have died as a result of their COVID infection.
Yep.
We are not doing nearly enough from a PPE standpoint to protect healthcare workers, and that has to be paramount. Right now, we're having a hard time trying to shore up our stockpiles of N95 respirators, gowns, gloves, because they're being consumed almost as fast as they're being produced. But I think if there was one priority, I would put it there, because as goes the healthcare workers of this country, will go the health of the public. If we can't provide better medical care in our hospitals, because we just don't have the trained, capable people to be there because they're sick themselves or they're dead, that's a horrible, horrible situation to find yourself in. So that's number one. Number two is I think we have to look at just how do you prepare your institution for the kind of care that we might be talking about. I worry that far too many healthcare providers think that we're over the worst, and we have a long ways to go. The third area is we have got to do more with the mental health aspects of providing this care to patients.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is we have had healthcare workers who have gone through anything that might have been seen in a war scene with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And, you know, watching many people a day die under their care. And so I think mental health aspects to our healthcare system is also very important. And then finally, I think just plan for how the community is going to respond or react. I think the public right now, as I said, is in the midst of severe pandemic fatigue. They were already locked up for far too long. Many of them saying, I don't even know anybody who's had COVID-19 yet. Well, I tell them you should be concerned about it, because just 90 days ago, this virus was not even among the top 75 causes of death in the United States. And last month, for a number of those days, it was the number one cause of death in the United States. We have not seen that happen since 1918.
Yeah.
So I say that as a healthcare community, be sensitive to the community itself. Understand when they're afraid, understand when they are concerned, and understand when they feel reassured. And you have to be part of that. We need to get the public straight talk. It needs to be very effectively communicated, and it needs to tell them and healthcare workers, this is step one, two, and three of what you need to do to protect yourself.
You know, speaking of straight talk, we've got a flu season coming up, and nobody seems to be talking about that. You know, if it was 1957 or 1967, all which were flu seasons where we lost about 100,000 lives in it, we're going to have to figure out how to both deal with the COVID virus, but also how are we going to give immunizations out to all the hundreds of millions of people who need it. What's your thinking about the two maybe converging around the same time that there's might be a second wave?
Well, actually, last week, my colleague, Dr. Ed Belanger, and I actually published an editorial in Science on this very issue, COVID-19 and influenza, a perfect storm, And we laid out exactly the challenges that you just so nicely summarized. And even to the extent of how do we get vaccine to our populations when we're worried about bringing people together with this COVID-19 situation. We urge strongly people be vaccinated for flu. We need to take as much of that off the table as we can. Surely we'd like to have a better flu vaccine than we do, but we have to do with what we can. So I refer people to the Science magazine article. Just go to the magazine Science and hit influenza or COVID and it'll pop up.
Perfect.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Michael Osterholm, world-renowned epidemiologist and director of the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. You can learn more about his vitally important work or follow his work on Twitter at CIDRAP, C-I-D-R-A-P. Dr. Osterholm, thank you so much for your decades of contribution to this vitally important discipline of global health and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In a May radio interview, presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden made a number of misleading or exaggerated claims regarding the coronavirus pandemic. Biden falsely suggested that he called for implementing nationwide social distancing restrictions prior to March 8, which Columbia University researchers said could have prevented nearly 36,000 U.S. deaths due to COVID-19 from then until early May. Biden exaggerated when he said he wrote an article about the coronavirus on January 27 that, quote, said this pandemic's here. Biden actually referred to the outbreak as a global health challenge and argued that Trump was not prepared to lead the country through, quote, the possibility of a pandemic. He also gave himself too much credit when he said, quote, I'm the guy that said we ought to find out exactly how many people in the Black community are getting COVID and are dying from it. On April 9, Biden joined several Democrats who had already called for the Federal Health Department to collect racial and ethnic demographic data on testing and treatment. The authors of the Columbia University study, which has not been peer-reviewed, calculated that had social distancing and other enforcement measures been widely implemented in the U.S. on March 8, rather than in mid-March, 35,927 of nationwide COVID-19 deaths could have been avoided. It's true that others, including health officials in Trump's own administration, said prior to March that social distancing would need to be enforced in order to slow the spread of the virus. But Biden's campaign didn't give us an example of Biden calling for social distancing by early March. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. If music soothes the savage beast, the question they want to answer at the Sync Project is, how exactly? There are lots of anecdotal studies supporting music's ability to trigger memory or boost endurance or focus, but virtually nothing is known about how music truly impacts our physiological and neurological state. This is the question that intrigued scientist Keiki Kuranam, a systems biology PhD from Harvard, who wondered, how could music be scientifically harnessed as a powerful precision medicine tool? They formed the Sync Project with a cross-section of neuroscientists, biologists, audio engineers, even some rock stars like Peter Gabriel, and started by using artificial intelligence systems to analyze existing playlists that purport to promote relaxation, induce sleep, enhance focus, or athletic performance.
And once we have this set of songs that our machine learning algorithms predict to be effective for a specific activity, we can then run studies using these devices like your heart rate monitors, your smart watches, your activity trackers, and actually look at how effective indeed is that song for that purpose.
Kuranam and her colleagues note that most of us self-medicate with music already, so why not harness this ubiquitous tool that's available to all of us and develop strategies and systems that might replace pharmacological interventions with musical ones? The Sync Project is seeking 1 million volunteers to offer their music suggestions, as well as any information they can share on why these songs seem to work for them.
So we're literally walking around with, 14 million songs in our pocket every single day. So we saw great opportunity on really being able to understand how music was affecting us, to measure how different types of music affect both our psychological health as well as our physiology.
Kuranam and her team seem vast potential for reducing reliance on drugs by crafting personalized music interventions in the management of a variety of complex conditions, such as pain management, PTSD, even Parkinson's disease.
In Parkinson's disease, patients have trouble coordinating movement. So by playing them the right kind of music, it can be an external auditory support they have that's going to help them walk more smoothly.
The Sync Project, combining computer technology and neuroscience, physiology, and musicology to harness the healing powers inherent in music to help manage a variety of human ills. Now that is a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.